TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Ilan Pape, in Gaza now, it's worse than ethnic cleansing. The Israeli historian Ilan Pape is interviewed by Darin Abu-Aida on Al Jazeera English. Darin Abu-Aida is a Palestinian-Lebanese broadcast journalist based in Doha, Qatar. She's currently working as the principal news presenter and host for Al Jazeera English. Darin previously worked for Bloomberg LP, CNBC, the World Bank, and the United Nations. Al Jazeera English is a 24-hour English language news channel. It is funded by the government of Qatar and the first worldwide English language news channel to be headquartered in the Middle East. Al Jazeera broadcasts in over 150 countries and territories and has a global audience of 430 million people. Darin Abu-Aida interviewed Ilan Pape on February 25, 2024. Here's her introduction after a quote from Ilan Pape.
I think it's worse than ethnic cleansing. This is ethnic cleansing which has turned into genocide. So from my perspective, what's happening now in Gaza is far worse than what happened in 1948.
Taking center stage today is Ilan Pape. He's an Israeli historian and professor at the University of Exeter. Pape is known for his outspoken views on the Israeli-Palestinian question, drawing both praise and criticism. He's the author of several books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, in which he challenges the traditional Israeli narrative over the establishment of Israel in 1948. In today's episode, Pape discusses the dangers of the Zionist ideology and its impact on Israel and Palestine, the historical context of October the 7th, and his vision for a one-state solution.
Professor Ilan Pape, thank you so much for speaking to Center Stage.
It's a pleasure to be on the program. Thank you for having me.
Before you left Israel to the UK in 2006, you were condemned in the Knesset. You were targeted. You were boycotted at the university that you worked at. I understand you also received death threats as a result of you speaking out in support of Palestinians. But as an Israeli Jew who lived in Israel, whose parents immigrated from Europe to Israel, where does this conviction to speak out come from?
It's actually a journey. It doesn't happen in one day. You don't have a moment of epiphany, so to speak, that suddenly you are willing to actually risk your association with your own society. In many ways, you have to deprogram yourself from an indoctrination that you were exposed to from very early age. In my case, I think what really helped was, first of all, the fact that I love history. And I knew always from a very early age that I would like to be an historian. And I was also very interested in the history of the place in which I was born, Haifa. And because I was looking at the modern history of Haifa and then of Palestine, I was exposed to, let's say, historical facts that challenged the indoctrination that I was exposed to. But I think what really, really helped was the fact that I, and it was just a coincidence, that I decided to continue my studies outside of Israel, in Britain, in the University of Oxford. And also by chance, I had an Arab supervisor, the late and great Albert Hourani. And through him, I met Palestinians on a different footing that I would have met them in Israel. So this intimacy with Palestinian colleagues and friends, being outside of the country, working on the most important year in the history of modern Palestine, 1948, created a certain confusion in my mind about who I am, the story, and so on. And slowly I began to take myself, if you want, out of the Zionist tribe, and became quite a critical voice against it.
Right. But so, I mean, many people would be interested to know that, in fact, you served in the Israeli military in the 1973 war.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a turning point, an incident which shaped your narrative today?
I should say I had a very conventional Israeli upbringing, which included going to the army because you have to serve in the army. And I was in the 1973 war. I was on the Golan Heights in the war between Syria and Israel. I saw things there that I think later also helped to shape my ideas, but I think it was, I was too young and too immersed in the Israeli mindset to be affected by the war itself. I think it came a bit later. It came a bit later. And when I should also say that, I mean, I became a mature scholar through a very important dramatic time. The Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, which was clearly, to me at least, not a war of choice, but an invasion. The first Intifada, when you had the first Palestinian uprising, seeing Palestinians fighting for freedom and independence, it also influences you. There's a moment you get up and you say, you're at peace with yourself. You are okay with what you think. You're willing to pay the price. You're not looking back because you know too much. And from then on, you become committed to the cause, to continue what you believe in.
Is that hard to do these days? I mean, how do you keep your moral compass? How do you hold on to such views when the Israeli society itself is a Zionist society as described by yourself and by many, and also the successive Israeli governments that come into power are extremely right and they're pretty much Zionist governments, particularly after the events of October the 7th. Yes. How do you keep that moral compass?
Well, I think what helps me that I already understood that this is going to happen when I wrote in the mid-1990s, when everybody was mesmerized by the Oslo Accord, I was writing very pessimistic articles. Everybody was writing hopeful articles that Oslo will bring peace between Israel and the Palestinians, and I was writing something very differently. I said, you don't understand the Israeli society, you don't understand the Israeli educational system. I could see what kind of young Israelis are being educated. I could envisage how Israel would look 10, 15 years or 20 years where we are now, onwards, because I understood that a new generation of Israelis, far more right-wing, far more extreme, far more Zionists, far more racist, are being educated in the school system. So I was ready, unfortunately, for the event. So it didn't shake me.
But let me ask you this. I mean, you're a historian. As a historian, what would you say is the most important historical context that people need to know today when it comes to Israel and Palestine as the Gaza war continues?
Yeah. I think there's more than one historical context. The first and most important one is probably the events of 1948. You cannot understand what happened on the 7th of October if you don't go back to 1948. If you don't understand how Gaza, the Gaza Strip, was created. Because most people don't know that before 1948, there wasn't such an entity called the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is an Israeli invention in 1948. Until 1948, Gaza was a small town, very cosmopolitical, because it was on the Via Maris between Alexandria and Alexandretta in Turkey. Many people passed through it. It had Jewish, Christian, and Muslim communities living there in coexistence and peace. And then came the Nakba, the catastrophe, the Israeli, what I called in my book, the ethnic cleansing. And what happened was that Israel was able, when it committed the ethnic cleansing, to expel Palestinians to Lebanon, to Syria, to Jordan. But Egypt did not allow Israel to expel Palestinians to Egypt. So Israel had a problem in the south. So they said, okay, we'll give up. They decided not to occupy Gaza. They decided to create this rectangle as a huge refugee camp so that they can push the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from the central and south of Palestine that Egypt did not want to receive, and to push it to 2% of historical Palestine and close it as a border and let the Egyptian take the military rule over that area. So from the very first moment in 1948, the Strip was a huge refugee camp under pressure and unbearable conditions already in 48. Of course, things became even worse after Israel occupied it in 1967, and even worse since 2007 when the siege on Gaza began. And then the 17 years of siege that included four bombardments of Gaza, which is probably what most young people in Gaza know, since many of them are in the early 20s. The only reality they know is the reality of siege and four bombardments from the air, the land, and the sea from 2007 until today. And on 7th of October, what came out is this whole reaction, both to the siege, but also to the fact that so many of the people in Gaza were refugees who were pushed into this strip from 1948 and were under military occupation.
You've written that book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, about what happened in 1948. And you said that it was noted by the world at the time, but not condemned. Is history repeating itself now when it comes to not only what we're seeing happen? Is it ethnic cleansing taking place in Gaza right now, in your opinion? And are some world governments complicit in what's happening?
First of all, I think it's worse than ethnic cleansing. I think what we see in Gaza now is genocide. And I don't think that what happened in 48 was genocide. And ethnic cleansing is bad enough. I mean, don't misunderstand me. And ethnic cleansing is an operation that is usually accompanied by massacres. But this is not ethnic. This is ethnic cleansing, which has turned into genocide. So from my perspective, what's happening now in Gaza is far worse than what happened in 1948. That's the first point. Secondly, I think you're right. I think that the same international indifference that allowed the Israelis to complete the ethnic cleansing in 1948 is also activated today. And today it's even less forgivable than it was in 48, because 48, there was no television, there was no internet. Unlike today, where the genocide is taking place in front of our eyes, we know every day what's going on, and the governments of the West, of the global North, are fully aware of what goes on, and they refuse to force Israel to accept a ceasefire. This is incredible that the United States administration willingly and knowingly gives Israel a carte blanche to continue the genocide now for more than 3 months.
What we see now is contextualizing and historicizing what's going on also triggers accusations of anti-Semitism. To what extent do you think that this is part of the settler colonial nature of Zionism?
Settler colonialism is a phenomenon of Europeans who became actually in many cases refugees in Europe or outcasts because they were not welcomed by Europe. For religious reasons, economic reasons, cultural reasons, and they felt that Europe was unsafe or Europe didn't want them. So they were looking for a new Europe outside of Europe. And very often they chose places where other people already lived. And what happened when they understood that there is an indigenous native population in the new places, they were willing to try and remove that population, either by genocide or by ethnic cleansing. So we usually say that they acted according to a logic of the elimination of the native. And Zionism is not a different case. Europeans felt unwelcome in Europe, but they still wanted to create a Europe. They chose Palestine because of the religious connection between Judaism through the Bible to the land of Palestine. With the help of, like all settler colonial movements, they got the help from an empire, Britain, but they were always working on this logic that I mentioned, the logic of the elimination of the native. But, you know, 48 became such an opportunity. They did not complete the elimination. They expelled half of Palestine's population, and half of Palestine's population remained in historical Palestine. They also did not take into account that those who were expelled would continue and create a liberation movement and would not give up their right of return and so on. So I think what we have here, in very simple terms, it's a project of having as much of the land with as few indigenous native people of it as possible.
Right.
Gaza is a problem. Gaza was always a problem for Israel. The West Bank was Judaized, was colonized, and there is now more than 700,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank. So Israel feels that even if there is a Palestinian problem in the West Bank, because you have such a huge Jewish presence, they have it under control. Gaza, they never succeeded in persuading enough Jewish settlers to go into. Only 3,000 went in. Eventually, Ariel Sharon said, let's take them out. They are more trouble than helping us, and decided to create this huge prison. And Gaza still became a problem. I mean, after they created the big prison in 2007, the Hamas continued its resistance. So it didn't solve the problem as far as they were concerned.
You're an advocate for the one-state solution.
That's right.
Tell us how this would work in your mind.
Yeah.
I mean, based on what you're saying and these decisions that are taken by the Israeli governments, it seems to be very challenging.
Absolutely. What it really means is that you cannot have a one-state solution as long as Zionism is the most important, the hegemonic ideology in Palestine. There's no chance for a one-state solution. There's no chance for any solution. Also, the two-state solution is not a solution as long as Israel is a Zionist state. So obviously, when we talk about a one-state as a vision for the future, we understand that it has to go through the de-Zionization of Israel, or the decolonization, if you want, of historical Palestine.
Now, these are big words. How do you see that disintegration happening?
Yeah, but what we can see very clearly is processes by which this project is not working, not just because of the Palestinian resistance, but because it has other organic problems. For instance, this whole idea of creating a state on the basis of religion never worked in any country in the world. The idea that you can create a state of Jews just because they all believe in the same religion is not a basis for nationalism. And we can see now the struggle inside the Jewish society between two camps, the secular Jews and the religious Jews. And they find it very difficult to find anything in common. So first of all, I think this is disintegrating from within. I think there is an implosion of the society from within. Secondly, the state relies so much on the United States that the moment that there is a scenario by which America, for whatever reasons, not necessarily pro-Palestinian reasons, is unable or unwilling to provide the financial and military aid to Israel, it has less capacity to keep its economy or its military capacity. So I think I'm much more clear about the disintegration of the Zionist project. I really think we are beginning to see the end of this.
Look, let me ask you this though. Would it be anti-Semitic then to advocate for the right of Palestinians to return, but not for Jews?
No, it will not be anti-Semitic. I'll explain. I think the right of the Palestinians to return to their homeland because they were expelled is very much grounded in international law. There is a clear United Nations resolution, 194, from the 11th of December 1948, that declares that the right of the Palestinians to return is sacred and internationally legal. So I think that that's a right that cannot be denied. This is not a political issue. This is an individual right of a refugee to go back home. The immigration of Jews to Israel is not a regular immigration law of a state. It articulates an unreasonable idea that any Jewish baby born anywhere in the world is automatically and potentially an Israeli citizen. You cannot turn every Jew in the world into a potential citizen of the future one state. No, the one state would have to distinguish between the right of the refugees to return and agree upon all the people who live there on its immigration policy. So I would totally separate the right of the Palestinian refugees to return, which is correcting an historical injustice, then the future of people who would like to, if at all, would like to come to what hopefully would become a democratic state all over Palestine, if they want to go there as Jews, as Christians, and so on.
But what will it take, Professor, for this idea of Zionism to disintegrate in Israel, for people, for the Zionists in Israel to start unlearning it? Because you speak of Jews who are outside of the United States, out of Israel, forgive me, or people outside of Israel who are now unlearning Zionism, but the real problem is in Israel itself.
Absolutely. If Israel ceases to exist as a Zionist state and is replaced by a democratic state, I predict that a lot of Jews, especially with European background, with European passports, with options of living outside, would leave. That happened to the white community in South Africa. I hope they will not, but I think some of them would leave. There's no doubt. The fact that this is a possible scenario is not a good enough reason to stop the injustice in Palestine. So I think we have to be honest with people. You know, you cannot describe a rosy decolonization, you know, saying to people, oh, don't worry, you just get up tomorrow morning and the Palestinians suddenly would be equal citizens, the refugees are coming back, and you don't want to even feel it. Your life will continue as it is. No, it won't, because you have many unjust privileges, which you're going to lose. You're going to feel quite unsafe at the beginning because someone else is now taking control. But this is unavoidable and necessary. It also means that we should not expect a change from within Israel as a precondition for the liberation of Palestine. This will happen despite the fact that most Israeli Jews would be against it.
Speaking of acceptance, I mean, when we talk about this one-state solution, so far it's confined, if I can say so, and correct me if I'm wrong here, to sort of intellectual circles, to historians like yourself. I mean, one of the recent polls that I was reading suggests that in 2023, support for the one-state solution stands at about 23% among Palestinians and 20% among Israeli Jews. And also, you have governments who are now trying to reinvigorate this idea of a two-state solution. So how can this idea for a one-state solution gain momentum? Do you think it's going to gain momentum going forward?
First of all, yes. So I think this is changing rapidly. What is important is the change in the position of Palestinians in the West Bank or under the Palestinian Authority, who are officially under a leadership that talks only about the two-state solution. The number of people who are for the one-state solution is growing exponentially every day, every day. I know it because I'm a member of a movement which is called the One Democratic State Campaign, and we are working in the West Bank as well as in Gaza and inside Israel, and the numbers are all the time growing, especially among the younger generation. And we have to remember, the Palestinian society is one of the youngest in the world. 50% of the Palestinians, wherever they are under 18. Mm-hmm. If you do a survey among young Palestinians, I guess, I don't know, I don't have the numbers, but I guess an overwhelming majority would be for a one-state solution. And you can see it because the young people use the internet more than the older generation, and they are less factionalized. So I think that there definitely we are going, I'm totally sure about it. I don't know exactly when, but in the medium-term future, I think that the Palestinian declared vision, even institutionalized vision, would move to a one-state solution.
What about acceptance amongst Israeli Jews?
They don't accept the two-state solution and they don't accept the one-state solution. I really think that their position is not relevant that much, because as long as most of the Israeli Jews are Zionists, and most of them are Zionists, they don't believe in any solution that could begin to address the injustices that Zionism inflicted on the Palestinians. This is why I think the most important strategy the Palestinians have adopted in recent years is the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanction. The logic of the BDS, which was copied from South Africa, the logic of the BDS is that you don't think that the society of the occupier is going to change from within, so you believe that boycott, divestment, and sanction would force it to change. So I think what matters is, do we have effective tools to force the Israelis to change?
Are there effective tools then to force change amongst the sort of political structures on both sides, as well as governments around the world?
We have to believe that there is. Otherwise, we have no hope for the future. If we don't believe that we have a chance of influencing the people who make policy in any country, then there's very little hope for humanity. I think young people around the world believe that they have the chance to change ecological policies. Young African Americans believe that they have a chance of making the American society more egalitarian. And young Palestinians believe that they have the power to liberate Palestine. So I think, yes, we have a chance. We have the tools. If we haven't done it yet, it means that we are either using the wrong tools or we are not using the tools correctly. But I think if this energy that young generation of Palestinians have would be translated into organization, namely, we need to see a new PLO. The new PLO has to include Hamas and the Jihad and other factions. You cannot have 4 or 5 Palestinian national liberation movements. They will never succeed if they continue like this. They need one organization, as they used to have, a democratic one, an authentic one, that represents all the diversified positions of Palestinians and agreeing on what they can agree. This can change policies of Palestinian leadership, of Arab leadership, and world leadership. Yes, I do think that there is a way of doing it, but there are certain conditions that have to be fulfilled so that these processes are becoming positive. Because the destruction, I think, of Israel from within will happen anyway. The problem is if there's no Palestinian, a proper Palestinian organization to take over, what you get instead of it is chaos.
Right.
And chaos can continue for 20, 30 years. So transitions have to be quick. Long transition periods usually destroy the achievements of liberation and decolonization. We've seen it in many African countries, for instance. So we hope that Palestine would go in a different path in the future.
Professor Ilan Pappe, real pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was an interview of the Israeli historian Dr. Ilan Pappe, author of The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. This program is dedicated to those who question the claim that the current war by Israel and Gaza began on October 7, 2023. The late great author and documentary filmmaker John Pilger called Ilan Pappe, quote, "Israel's bravest, most principled, most incisive historian." Richard Falk, professor of international law at Princeton, wrote, "Ilan Pappe has written a book that is of profound relevance to the past, present, and future of Israel-Palestine relations." End quote. Darin Abu Aida interviewed Ilan Pappe on February 25, 2024 for Al Jazeera English, the first worldwide English language news channel to be headquartered in the Middle East. They now have a global audience of 430 million people. Darin Abu Aida previously worked for Bloomberg, LP, CNBC, and the World Bank. You can find the 25-minute video of this conversation on YouTube under the title, "In Gaza Now, It's Worse Than Ethnic Cleansing." You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.